we were so desperate for raising money. We took money from a school teacher in Austin. You want to fight a war as a business. You want generals who have fought wars and have a shared context and shared belief. So we knew from day one, it has to be one product solving, you know, five use cases instead of like five products solving, you know, five use cases. For you to create value, you really have to understand, you know, your customer context, their operating context, their workflows context, their pain point context, and their switching, you know, costs kind of a context, right?
The fact that you would just be a fantastic custodian of our capital, I was sort of done even before I sort of heard the idea.
And the US is a market where people value their time more than their money, so let's go there and, you know, sell our software.
Probably have five CTOs on the team, not just one.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Matrix Moments. It's my great privilege to welcome Vijay Rayapati. We're now officially announcing our investment in Atomic Work. It's now more than a year since we've been talking, and you know, we invested along the way. He's been in stealth, so this is really the coming out party, and it's been an honor to sort of both invest as well as learn from you. So welcome.
Thank you, Vikram. Pleasure too, and thank you for trusting us to partner with me, Kiran, and Pursu.
So I'm very excited about this episode because Vijay has a phenomenal founder journey, and then he is going into this, you know, super hot Gen AI meet SaaS space. So we're going to spend about 50% of our time working through his founder journey and how he, you know, ended up founding Atomic Work, and the rest around, you know, Gen AI and Atomic Work. So let's start with the journey. And I was, you know, initially we didn't have the journey in the podcast. And I was like, we spent the first 20 minutes when we first met on your journey, and I was done. And I wanted to invest. So, you know, would love to hear that from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, no, thank you. I think, so I grew up in a village not very far from Bangalore, around 400 kilometers near Hampi. Had a very interesting childhood. First couple of years, I went to a village school. It's not even a school, one teacher just teaching, you know, all the kids in the school. Then my aunt came from Hyderabad and she said, okay, this is not the school and you can't learn like this. So she said, okay, I'll take you to Hyderabad, near Hyderabad. And so we went there. So I studied already for, I think, 4 years in this school. We went there and I said, I studied, completed third standard, and you know, I want to get started with fourth. School after school said, we will not give you admission in fourth because there is no certificate of your study, but we will give you admission in first standard, right? So I didn't want to go back to first. And one of the teacher basically said, why don't you write seventh? Used to be a board exam in early 90s in Andhra. Wrote it with a bare minimum marks. Got through, and you know, while, you know, it kind of gave me acceleration a few years of not doing this formal schooling, but it also caused a lot of trouble because I was always the youngest in the class and the shortest, right? Which was both good and bad. The bad is everybody would bully you. The good is, you know, you learn to deal with it. And the funny thing was, in Minjar, once there was a colleague of mine, Raj Raman, and he introduced me to his father. And his father was really shocked because Raj was, by then, I think he was already like 50 plus. And I was in probably, you know, just getting to my 30s. So this was the start of, he was like, you work for this boy? So this has always been like that. But I think super fortunate. You know, I think being young helps you. And now when I look back, I always felt that I think I learned most during my schooling, like, and, you know, my engineering. And because you are pushed to learn and make, you know, friendships, because nobody wants to be friends with the youngest guy in the class, right? Because you're like super short, right? And I was so short, you won't believe. the only wish I had in my life to God was just make me taller, right?
So, you know, you've said that entire episode and story very humbly and in short. But for me, when I heard it first, what stood out was the grit, because you kept sort of getting bullied and like getting, you kept falling on your on your face, but you kept picking yourself up through all of that. And the second was just the fact that you would just learn whatever you didn't know. You would just say, I can learn this and keep going. And those two things actually make phenomenal founders. And you ended up becoming that also very early with Minjar. So talk about early parts of that and also how you think that ecosystem has evolved. And I saw this post that you had on sort of the how SaaS has grown in the India ecosystem then and now.
No, I think it's 10 years since Minjar journey, right? 2013 to 2023. It feels like we made 100x progress as ecosystem, you know, broadly. But I think personally, for me, was so I think I feel like even though like there was a lot of adversity, you know, along my journey, and I think the timing somehow worked out, right? Always, right? You know, it was like my aunt just moved to Hyderabad, you know, so it worked out for me to get education. And, you know, I went to a college in Hyderabad, which is like the first engineering college of the state. Somehow, even though I never studied in English medium, so until then I studied in Telugu medium. So when I was in Karnataka, I studied in this Telugu plus Kannada. So there was like this transitions, but one good thing that has happened was, you know, somehow this movements of, you know, along the journey, there will be some people who kind of influence you. Similarly, so I tried one startup before this Minjar thing, it didn't work out. Then I went become a CTO at GizaPage, where I was trying to build this social analytics system. And since it's a data processing kind of system, you have to use cloud. And the folks who were giving a lot of credits even then was not AWS, Azure. You know, was giving like quite a bit of credits even in 2009. And, you know, AWS was also giving a little bit of credits. They didn't have a formal program. So we used, you know, that system to build our app, right? But before that, I was at Trilogy where we had to build a distributed file system. And even though the end use case was just data processing of records for one of the largest financial institution, most of the product work we did was building this distributed file system. And cloud came up, like the first thing that came to my head was, oh my God, okay, I don't need to now build one more, you know, distributed file system kind of an app, you know, for a data processing use cases, I can just use this object store. And as we built it, GizaPage, you know, it took off, we had some early traction, you know, sold it to, not so great brands now like Kingfisher, Coffee Day. So these were all our customers back then. Jet Airways and, you know, Titan and a few others. But like the business model was like we could not go sell directly this thing to the brand. Yeah. We have to go through agencies. And the going through agencies was like they'll take 80% cut of whatever you are trying to sell, right? And otherwise, there is no entry. You go to the brand, you know, you pitch them. They say, okay, this agency is handling my everything. So you go sell your social analytics solution to them. Then we said, okay, this is not going anywhere. And then I kept thinking, okay, I think there is an opportunity to build a cloud management kind of a system, right? Because even the cloud simplified a lot of things on infra through APIs, still felt operationally it is still complex. That's how the Minjar journey got seeded. And as luck would have, people offered us money, but they were not great terms. And back then, you know this better than anyone, you know, raising seed for SaaS is like, so SaaS was not the hottest thing, right? E-commerce was the hottest thing, you know, you go meet people, you know, page, they say, why SaaS, you know, do e-commerce, you know, kind of a thing. But some, you know, one group offered us, you know, angel check, but we said, okay. The terms were not super favorable. So we tried bootstrapping by raising money from few people. We were so desperate for raising money. We took money from a school teacher in Austin, so Nancy Langner. And so Anand, my co-founder, just moved to Austin. So we set up, and his son used to go to the school. That's how he met Nancy. She really used to like Indian tea. She used to come home. And me and Anand will be on calls and discussing, you know, hey, we need to raise this 100K.
I didn't know this story. Yeah. And I was anyway going to say that you make the most of every opportunity afforded. But this is truly like
so
hustle.
You, because as a founder, you obviously have to, you know, see, you know, what best you can get out of these interactions. She wrote actually one of our biggest angel checks. For Minjar, the biggest angel check came from Nancy Langna. And I told her it's a bad idea. She actually wanted to write 100K. I said she was a school teacher. Through all her journey, she probably saved 150K, 200K, less than 200K. And she wanted to put 100K. I said, look, startups mostly fail. And it's a terrible idea. I think her check gave us like a lot of motivation to keep working and face all these adversities and stuff. And I also used her conviction in us to convince even our Ashish Gupta to write a 50K. I said, Ashish, if a school teacher can write 40K, you can write 50K. So, you know, just put a check in us. And during the journey, we built good relationship with AWS. And it helped us gain traction. And, you know, I think it's been a good journey.
So I think you were highly resourceful during that journey where you essentially use revenue to fund you.
Yes,
the most part. Yeah. Through ups and downs, and it felt like that you pulled a rabbit out of a hat. Every time your back was against a wall with 2 months of runway, it was one more deal that saved you in some way.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's true. I think a lot of times we were almost on a deathbed. And sometimes we convince our customers to pay us upfront. You know, and we literally tell them, saying, you know, look, we need money. And, you know, please help us. You know, sometimes, you know, this friends who helped us, you know, folks like Pallav, you know, Rishi and Ankur from US, these people helped us. So somehow we were trying to build this software in an infra layer. And there were not many successful infra companies from India. So people didn't have conviction that, you know, you can actually build infra, you know, on top of infra software. And two was, but what really worked well in our favor was, you know, cloud really took off. Even I didn't expect that, you know, it will take off so well. Since we were like one of the earliest, you know, startups trying to build on top of AWS to help AWS customers, I think the AWS teams, including Werner and most of the leadership, you know, really helped us by giving us visibility and encouraging us to be at their conferences, giving us speaking slots. So that kind of helped us earn some of these customers because, like, you know, what's a better endorsement than, you know, AWS CTO, like, you know, bringing you on a panel to talk about things. And sometimes we even did, you know, consulting work, you know, to win customers. In the end, we knew that we had to raise money to scale. And we did all the classic mistakes of first time SaaS founder, of trying to first sell in India, then try to sell in Singapore, you know, this Asia. Wasted quite a bit of time. And then we said, okay, US is a market where people value their time more than their money. So let's go there and, you know, sell our software. We went there. And that was very painful because then we had to shut down our Singapore, you know, entire focus, even let go some customers. You know, and that's when we said, okay, we needed to raise, you know, little bit more than this 50K, 100K checks will not help us.
And it felt like everything came together at the same time. You got a term sheet, you got Nutanix, and then you ended up, you know, sort of putting everything together and ended up selling to Nutanix.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about the process and also how you really thought about it as a founder at that time. Because, you know, often, especially that vintage, selling was equal to selling out.
Correct.
Some ways, right? But, you know, I think that sale provided huge impetus to the rest of your journey.
So, actually, when we went to US the first time, I think we went there in 2016. So, from 2014, we started making trips, but it was a little hard for us. So, 2014 November during reInvent is when we launched the solution. And 2015, we wasted mostly time here. But 2015, I made like a couple of trips, got a few customers. We said, okay, it's better to shift focus. But we also know that, you know, this cockroach startup approach won't work, you know, which is like, okay, you save 5K a month, 10K a month from your cash flows, you know, because just the tickets and stay, you know, will eat up all that additional cash, right? So we said, okay, we needed to raise some money. And then I said, okay, maybe, you know, I'll go to US and pitch in US and try to raise money in US, right? And so luckily, even though we could not raise institutional money, one of our customer, he bought like a 100K plus subscription per year. He bought a multi-year subscription. And he was also willing to put another couple of $100,000 into company. He said, I really like this software. I really want you guys to survive. And so we met them at one of this, you know, events, you know, and really good folks, Beyond Soft. And so that actually gave us like a lot of conviction that, hey, we can actually go sell this hundreds of thousands of dollars software here. And, you know, and some of them are willing to give money upfront, right? Some of them are willing to pay for 6 months, even a year in upfront. So we said, okay, we can invest. Then we took a house in Santa Clara. And between me, Anand, Raj, you know, like Akash, Amar, like bunch of our other folks, two of us always used to be in US, right? So the maximum, just go meet customers, pitch and show the product and stuff. Because cloud was taking off, I think from 2014 itself, we started getting acquisition offers, right? Initially, it was like for a few million dollars kind of an offer. But we said, no, we can actually build. And then people offered, you know, 5, 10 million kind of a deals. Then in, I think in 2016, when we decided, okay, we needed to raise money, then we started talking to a few investors. So there was one deal where I thought I will actually sell the company. So that deal was from a, you know, US company to buy Minjar for, you know, 18 million. And in my head, I was like, I will not sell if it is less than 20 million, right? So now if I think, you know, it's irrational, I don't have a logic, but the logic I was having at that point was, okay, we are getting close to 2 million ARR. A 10X is like, you know, minimum, you know, I could expect. And it's in a good space. And they were basically saying, hey, you know, we can actually build this software in 2 years, you know, blah, blah, you know, kind of a thing. And, but initially they offered 15 and they said, okay, at 18, we will kind of do it. And so I used that opportunity to go to Bloom and, you know, bunch of others to give me money, but I took money at $12 million, you won't believe, right? So I felt very stupid, man, why am I like leaving $18 million offer on table and going to an investor now taking money at like $12 million, right? $11 to $12 million. But we had a conviction thinking, you know, look, we can actually build on this. So then two things we started noticing. So some of the competitive players in our space in US were raising large rounds, right? And so we know that, you know, now we need like dollars to go and win in go-to-market. So we said, okay, this $2, $3 million fund commitment which we got, and then we had to do this usual India thing, right? Which is like restructure, you know, thing, you know, fix, you know, certain things, you know, you can't have, you know, debt from a customer, you have to pay it back, you know, all these things. And so by then it was already like 2017, May or so. We did one of our big conference also, India Cloud Summit, you know, here. And so I was basically thinking, okay, we need to raise a larger round. So that's why I was in the valley again. So I was like most of middle of 2016 and most of 2017, I was in the valley, most of it. To an extent that, you know, like the guy at the port of entry used to ask, hey, you left just like last week, why are you back again? Right? So, in that process, I started actually pitching to people. By then, we were got close to 3 million plus ARR. And so one of our angel, Ankur Jain, who runs Emergent Ventures, so he basically connected me to Dheeraj. So I was about to leave, you know, so it was like a Saturday afternoon kind of introduction. And I was leaving on Sunday afternoon. Because that was the cheapest ticket, because the Saturday, Friday tickets were like very expensive to India. And so I was, so I got this introduction and then Dheeraj basically responded saying, hey Vijay, good to meet you and I want to meet you. And I told him, hey, I'm leaving, so we'll meet next time. He said, no, we can meet early morning. By then they were already, they just went IPO, they were already at like almost $1 billion kind of ARR. And so I thought, he will say, okay, we'll meet next. But that guy responded saying, no, I want to meet you the earliest. I said, okay, when? He said 6 a.m. I was like, wow, 6 a.m. So then we went and met at one Starbucks. It was not open because most Starbucks open at 6:30. So for 30 minutes, we were just walking around. Then we spoke from like 6:30 to almost like probably 10 o'clock. And so Dheeraj was like trying to take this on-prem. So they built this on-prem cloud and he wanted to turn it into hybrid cloud. And we were basically trying to, you know, we built a layer of software to manage this public cloud. So he thought, you know, bringing this software to this will help their customers have, you know, do hybrid cloud management. So that was his thesis. So initially I basically told, don't buy my company, just give me money. You know, I will build, we can do partnership and all. By then, one of the large cloud provider wanted to do OEM with us. It was a great opportunity for us, you know, as a company. But I was also scared because, you know, you go do this OEM deal with this large cloud provider and then you are stuck, right? Because they're, you know, they wanted, yeah, they control our destiny because they were willing to pay $5 million a year just for the software. And the moment, now my relation, so I was just trying to build my relationship with Azure and, you know, then with GCP, etc. And they will back out because then they will think, okay, one of the other player has, you know, bigger stake in this company. So I said, okay, that's a bad idea. So I should not probably do that deal. Even though revenue-wise, it was like super attractive kind of a deal for us. So I was basically trying to raise the Series A of $5 million. So $5 million, so it was like my raise thing. Then Dheeraj basically said, you know, hey, we can actually build a much bigger company. And I really, you know, if you guys...
So go a little bit deeper than that, because, you know, I know that that conversation with Dheeraj and your chemistry with Dheeraj sort of weighed the deal in that favor versus, you know, taking this OEM deal or the Series A and so
on. Yeah, my flight ticket. So basically what I told... So then Dheeraj, after this 10 o'clock, he basically said, why don't you stay back? I think there is something here. We should have further conversations. I told him, look, I'm a small startup. I can't afford to waste my flight ticket. So if you pay for my flight, I'll stay. Right? He said, don't worry, man, I'll pay. Okay. So that was a little embarrassing, but I was also like, you know, it's like a, you know, almost $1,000, right? So more than $1,000, I think. So, but I stayed back. Somehow I felt we hit off because I think we had a similar backgrounds, right? So he came to Patna. He also stayed with his, you know, aunt, if I'm not wrong. So in a small house. So when we shared some of our things, it was like my aunt, you know, when me and my brother, we were with my aunt, you know, it was like a one bedroom and there was a small hall and one kitchen. So Dheeraj's thing is also like quite similar. And so then we had, he worked, Dheeraj's first internship, if I'm not wrong, was with Trilogy or his first job. So I also had with Trilogy. So I think in this Trilogy, we had this notion that the best of the best get into Trilogy, right? So I think some of those things kind of like normalized the first conversation to an extent where we said, you know, we really liked each other. And so I think I was also like very fascinated by their journey, right? So until then I heard about them, you know, once or twice before. We did some presentation at Stanford. Where like one of their corp dev guy came, you know, etc. But then Dheeraj told me like, you know, how late they came into the game. So the company started after the public cloud, against VMware, against like, you know, these classic SAN players and all, you know, in like in a short span, they could actually go after and built a very large revenue base and went IPO, you know, they were like probably one of the fastest companies to go IPO, right? They went IPO in like less than nine years, if I'm not wrong. And so I was like quite interested in understanding his, you know, approach, you know, his leadership and stuff. And so in that, like we had like a lot of back-to-back conversations, right? Like we were like just like texting like teens, me and him, like on WhatsApp and meeting again and again and again. And one thing I felt like a big difference compared to others. So there were like a bunch of other big US companies also wanted to acquire us. Every time we went, I always felt they used to say, oh, you're from India. Okay, you're an Indian company. Okay, you go talk to the GM or that VP kind of a thing. But in Nutanix, I basically felt the founder, CEO was like so interested. And the team was like, my God, you guys built this from India. You know, you did this from India. You know, and they were like, we felt like a sense of a lot of respect, right? Lot of respect, right? And the funny thing, you won't believe, like after Nutanix gave us the offer, there was one more very large company in US, they're still a very large company. They gave us a much better offer than, you know, Nutanix, at least like another 5 million more. But me and Anand said, you know, we have to go to a place where, you know, culture-wise it works for us, right? It's not just about money.
So I'm going to tease out a few learnings from that journey, especially for people who are looking to, you know, get acquired and so on. I think the first is, you know, that deep chemistry that you build, and you just trusted your gut on this chemistry. And I think it was what you felt from Dheeraj was the respect, but also that he was invested in your success, right? Both personally, and I know that played out, continues to play out to even today, right? But if you find those people who are sort of investing behind you as a founder, then I think that works out long term in your journey. And the second is what you said on the culture. I think one of the things that works with the Nutanix Minja merger was that the teams just integrated very quickly. Different people found different homes in Nutanix, not just you know, do this, right? I mean, what you ended up doing was not Minjar. You ended up doing so
networking,
many different
networking, security, and
you ended up doing different things because, you know, he was committed to you as a as a founder.
I think great. I think that is so true, right? I think the team, the culture, you know, I think matters a lot. Because I spoke to one of the founder who sold to this other company, which gave us a better offer. You know what he told? He said, Vijay, I sold this company here for $250 million. I am nobody here. Okay. And I am like, you know, the distance between me and the CEO is like four layers, right? So I'm just not enjoying, right? I'm actually planning to leave. Right. So I basically felt, okay, shit, it doesn't matter, right? So I think what really matters is, you know, going there where you can actually work with the founder CEO directly, and the entire leadership is like so good to you and to my team also, right? My team first time basically felt, why are these people treating us so well, right? Is there something here? I said, nothing, we are just trying to do a partnership, right? Because I also didn't want to tell team. So in my entire conversation also as a founder, I never went to team and said, we have an offer, this is the offer, etc. Because most of the times you folks know this, these things might not turn out, right? They might not happen. Then the team should not get disappointed, thinking, my God, why this acquisition didn't happen. So I never told. And most of the times, I didn't even tell my co-founders, right? Until like, you know, like there is something concrete, then I used to tell my co-founder. And even in Nutanix case, and after we signed the letter of intent and all the due diligence happened, and they came to our office to record the video, right? And everybody's like, why they are recording video and all. Then I called few of my
and close
because
folks. It's a public company, you can't talk about
right,
it also.
Right, we can't talk about it. And two is also, I'm like, look, until the thing is done, it's not done, right? Because I have seen this earlier as well. But the team, I mean, like a lot of people still continue with them.
So I think one part of that Nutanix story that or the sales story that stands out is you had a term sheet signed and the deal hadn't closed, but you still honored that deal and you made sure that the investors were made whole and they got the upside as if they had invested, even though that investment happened maybe like a month before.
Yeah.
And that really stood out for me. Very few founders do that. And for me, you know, the your origin story and this, the fact that you would just be a fantastic custodian of our capital, I was sort of done even before I sort of heard the idea. And I think very few founders sort of do that. Fast forwarding through this Nutanix journey, and I know because we have to get to the second part of the Atomic Work journey. Talk a little bit about one or two learnings from that Nutanix journey, which you're applying today. I know the startup was always on the card, so you were always, you know, preparing for your next big move, but what stood out from that, seeing a company at that scale?
Yeah, I think two or three things, right? So generally, most of the times as founders, we don't develop enough, I think, deep courage and a super long conviction to take on a big incumbent, right? And especially from a SaaS kind of a side. You know, and in Nutanix, what I have seen is, you know, you can really go take on a big incumbent by building a far superior product and a great customer support, right? So I'll tell you, like, I used to go on this support calls at Nutanix, and you know, obviously customers will get frustrated because something didn't work, but they always used to appreciate saying, you know, what I love about this company is you guys show up to solve my problem, right? I think the big takeaway for me was, you know, like the scale of ambition, and you can just go pick an industry that's like, you know, I mean, Dheeraj went and picked up, you know, a distributed storage, right? So storage is like not a sexy industry in 2010. You know, it was probably, you know, sexy thing in 80s and 90s. But he really felt that, you know, this, you know, disorganized storage in data centers is a big problem. And you have to build far superior solution by building a distributed, you know, file system. And a lot of people, Dheeraj told me once, a lot of people told him that, you know, you are late 30 years to market or, you know, things like that. And then he said, okay, let's go build a compute, right? Because, you know, you can actually do great value delivery to customer when you can provide a compute, not just storage software. And then he said, okay, let's go build networking software. Let's go build database software, right? So these are all like what I call like a $10 billion bets. You know, these are not like simple problems, right? At one point, he even asked a couple of us, he pulled us together and said, why don't we go build an operating system, right? And we all thought like, you know, is it real? Like, you know, are you saying, should we go build an operating system? He said, yes, you know, because he said, like, the more you go solve deeper problem, the better company you can actually go build, and you can own customer workloads and, you know, their workflows, right? I think the big things is, you know, the scale of ambition. You never be afraid of scale of ambition, right?
I think those two things really stand out from what you said. Scale of ambition and then being completely outside in,
yeah,
in the thought process saying, yeah, what will it take, yeah, to win
and
this customer?
And boring and unsexy problems.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm a big believer of this. You have to go solve complex problems, and also they're boring problems, right? Why? Because as a humans, we get super excited about solving sexy complex problems like a blockchain problem or an AI problem. Yeah. But the real money is in, you know, these boring problems, which are also super complex, yeah, right? So, I mean, like, I would say recently somebody said, hey, Intuit pulled out of India. I genuinely believe there's a great opportunity to go build something. Yeah. But most of us as founders, you know, we always get, you know, biased towards this sexy emerging domains, while the, you know, tens of billions of dollars are left, you know, in the back office problems, front office problems.
So I see this is a great segue into the Atomic story. So scale of ambition, yeah, complex, boring problems, yeah, and being completely outside in terms of customer pain point.
Yeah.
But before we go there, I think you also had one point about leadership, right? And as companies go,
yeah,
through this scale-up journey, and I think you had mentioned this time you want to groom leaders versus hire leaders. So
yeah,
what's the thought, yeah, process?
No, I think, so typically what happens is, you know, the founder started the company, the founding team and all, you know, we built some product, you know, bring growth, you know, like when timing works out, you know, go to market works out, and you build a superior product, you know, the growth scales, right? And the scaled growth brings complexity. And suddenly to solve that complexity, what we think is, we basically think, okay, let's put some processes, you know, to manage this complexity. And but they will say, okay, we have to bring people who really know, you know, how to manage this complexity, right? And then we end up hiring leaders, right? So I think one of the thing, you know, I learned at Nutanix is, despite having a far superior product, great market traction, if you don't hold your leadership team for long enough, the early leadership, and if you bring like a lot of these guys or, you know, the girls from big companies, it's very hard for them to get into the context, right? So I mean, I often tell people, it's super easy to manage a $5 billion business unit to then even build a $50 million business. It's like, you can easily manage because I have seen that, you know, and Nutanix, it's easy for you to manage, you know, a $5 billion business unit versus, you know, building even a $50 million, you know, business. I think, so while Dheeraj, you know, created, I mean, he always used to tell me, we have to groom and grow leaders, you know, we can't just import them, you know, and obviously he decided to leave Nutanix and then we had new leadership and, you know, whatnot. I think one of the thing I genuinely believe is if you look at any company, you take, for example, Amazon, right? The average tenure of an SVP at Amazon is 10 plus years, right? At Microsoft, it's 8 plus years, right? So what really worries me is, you know, this startups, you know, they become super successful. Just before IPO, you know, they go bring this people, just like Nutanix has done, you know, a bunch of other companies have done. And these leaders, it's super hard for them to understand the context. And then they start, you know, trying to operate like a super big company. You know, this early teams, you know, start leaving the company. That kind of becomes like, you know, slows down the company's growth and probably, you know, leads them to a territory where they don't have these generals who fought so many wars. They're ready to take on the new war, right? And we think, okay, these people can't scale, right? So I genuinely believe that a lot of your leadership has to be groomed. Because see, when you want to fight a war, right? As a business, you know, you are at a war against your competitor, you know, against naysayers, against, you know, market changing market dynamics. You want generals who have fought wars and have a shared context and shared belief. And I told this to Dheeraj once, you know, when I joined the company in the first 6 months, for one critical decision, he called me and said, what do you think? You know, what I told him, I said, you know, me giving feedback is, you know, I'll give you my opinion, but look, I don't have still an emotional attachment to this company. It will probably take a year or two for me to, you know, really, really get into that emotional bonding, you know, with the company. Probably it's better, you know, if you ask, you know, the first set of folks about what they think about, you know, that decision. And he really said, look, I really respect you, you know, saying, okay, just because I landed here, I'm the youngest executive, let me just go, you know, give all my gyan. But I genuinely believe, you know, especially from an India context, I think our ecosystem is far matured. Vikram asked this. I think we have to groom a lot of talent. Because when we import talent, it doesn't work. Look at Flipkart journey. They tried importing a bunch of leadership. It just doesn't work. It's nothing to do with those people. It's not like the people are bad. You know, it's just that when startups grow so rapidly, you also want, you know, the talent density of people who are willing to go do that work day every day and have a belief and not get afraid that Amazon just came into country. What happens to us? What happens if Alibaba comes into country, you know, kind of a thing. They're like, hey, when we were nobody, we took on them. You know, today we are at least someone, you know, we can easily take on them, right? So for me, when I looked at Atomic Work, you know, putting together the team, etc., I really, really wanted to have this thing of like, you know, like a lot of that leadership has to be emerged and created. It's great if you can find some of them from day one. Or, you know, our day 10 or day 10,000, it doesn't matter. But we have to have, otherwise the leaders will struggle, the teams will struggle, the culture will struggle. And most growth problems in companies are caused not by competitors, not by your product. It is by your leadership and your processes. You know, I'm a big believer of that.
Awesome. So since you mentioned Atomic, and we'll switch gears and talk about Atomic. So first I want to talk about the founders and the founding team, right? So usually founders will fall into that sort of zone of trusted relationships and comfort, right? So when we see founding teams, it's either friends from college, co-workers, sometimes family members, but people you know and know really well, right? Yeah. You went and found Kiran and Parsu, right? And you've not... really work together, maybe you know them from somewhere, but why that decision, so, which is something we usually don't see, and more so with experienced people who have the network. And for everyone, I think Kiran and Parsu were founding team members at Freshworks. I think they were the fourth and fifth employees there. And but I wanted to hear your story. And maybe the second one is that given it was a new relationship, how did you groom that and get to the point where you said that, hey, let's do this together?
Yeah. So I think somebody told me this. I forgot who told me this. They said, you know, building a company is like making a movie. Okay. If you make the movie with the same cast, same crew, okay, it's going to get boring. And mostly you make a very, you know, predictable movie, right? And so even if, Minjar, if you look at me and Anand didn't go to same school, we didn't have anything common, right? The only common thing is I worked for him for a year, or a little over a year at Kuliza as a CTO. And so even before that, also I always found people, because I also believe building companies, you know, discovering people, right? So let's take an example, right? So I have met like a lot of founders who start from their schoolmate as a co-founder. And the guy's natural view is he still thinks of him like, in school he used to be like this, that's why he's behaving like this. In college he used to be like this, that's why he's doing like this. You know, kind of, you know, stereotyping. And two, you know, when you want to start a company, you want to start company with people who generally show patience and perseverance, right? So I read, I'm generally a reader and I read like a lot of books, you know. So one of the book I read, it basically about essence of leadership, all it says is, if you have patience and perseverance, you know, add curiosity to it, you can do, you know, really good things in life. And so I always say, it's great if you find somebody, you know, from a network, but then, you know, you don't challenge each other, right? You know, they can't challenge you, you can't challenge them. And the deeper the relationship is, the trust levels are high, but the emotional baggage is also super high, right? And, you know, in the valley, you know, is one place where I have seen people with, you know, like a little bit of shared context actually come together and build good companies, right? Of course, you hear the stories of, you know, people dropping out of a college, you know, classmates, you know, building companies here or in US. But, you know, like in lot of, in enterprise, you know, you also see like a lot of people coming together and, you know, building it. So what's the risk? The risk is there is no trust level among them and they don't have a shared context of why are we doing, what do we value, how do we behave if things don't work out. So one of the thing me, Parsu and Kiran did, this is the same thing I did with Anand and, you know, other folks at Minjar as well, was spend time trying to understand why they want to do a company and, you know, how they will behave if, you know, we disagree, who makes the final call and, you know, how do we help each other and how do we also keep each other in a way that, you know, we don't, you know, like a lot of times, you know, these days, like, you know, people ping me and say, I'm having problems with my co-founder. Can you please join the conversation to have the difficult conversation? I said, the fact that he's a co-founder, you can have a difficult conversation. You don't need like a third party to come and have a difficult conversation. You folks would have seen this like more often, right? So we spent quite a bit of time, you know, we tried to understand personal interests. We learned about spouses, you know, our, you know, backgrounds, even though we know, even though I knew Kiran for a long time. You know, why I knew Kiran for a long time is I tried selling him multiple times software. Every time he tried to challenge me. So at one point, even before this whole Atomic happened, I thought, okay, if I do a company, I have to find this guy to come and work with me. Why? Because like his bar is very high. He's no nonsense guy. And there was an opportunity, you know, to come together. But we spent time, I think we spent 6 months, more than 6 months, just like, you know, trying to learn and understand, you know, discuss about like a lot of personal things and values. What happens if things don't work out, right? Who makes the call, right? And how do we deal with our emotions, right? I basically told them, look, I mean, you know, I am, you know, people might say he's a very nice guy, you know, but I can be like, you know, super high intensity person, you know, in execution that might actually stress you out, right? And so after a point, we basically felt, okay, I think there is like commonality, right? And we also said, look, we can't commit and say, sorry, my things have changed, you know, now I'm not committed to it, right? We have to, if we commit, you know, then we have to commit. Otherwise, let's not commit, you know, to this. What I really liked is both of them had a similar background, you know, like mostly tier 3, tier 4, you know, town. You know, first time, even Kiran told, the first city he went to is Chennai, right? When somebody told him restroom means, you know, he thought it's a sleeping room. You know, it's not like a washroom, right? Because, you know, when you come from these places, you know, you're not used to this taxonomy or terminology, right? And when I met, you know, I basically felt, okay, there is like a lot of shared thing. And I also felt both of them have patience and perseverance, right? So like very, very rarely people stay for 10 years in companies, you know, rarely, right? And even if they're co-founders also, they think, you know, after 4 or 5 years, they think, okay, I'll go build, you know, one more thing, you know, why should I be here? Even if that is a successful company, right? And so the both of them showed patience and perseverance. And I also felt, you know, they were very curious people, you know, in general. And there is a, like a lot of shared culture and context. We can actually, you know, come together, you know, to build this company. And so it is still early, you know, just a year. We need to see, you know, what happens in the decade. But so far, you know, it's been a fun ride.
So one of the things that stood out for me, we were doing these conversations remote, right? Yeah. Kiran, Barsu, yeah. We were all in different locations. And I think in the first, at the end of the first conversation, your kids showed up.
Yeah.
And it was very normal for your kids to show up in your conversations.
Yeah.
And you guys knew the names of each other's kids and,
yeah.
and so on. It just gave me a sense of how much you had invested, even though you were in three different locations,
yeah.
how much you had invested in each other personally,
yeah. Yeah.
getting to know each other.
Yeah, because you know, the families play a big part, right? So Dheeraj often says this, as a founder, you are at a war and you really need a peace at home. Right? So that means, you know, that your family is making probably a lot more sacrifice than you to really go on this journey. And one of the things all three of us have done is just like, you know, bring families together, you know, so because see, we will have like a lot of situations where we have to know that, this is beyond a professional relationship, right? And anywhere, even if you're not a co-founder, you know, it's beyond professional relationship. And that's why in Minjar, we used to always do these family days where we used to tell people to bring their parents. And once I had this person who said, my parents are from a village, you know, like, you know, they're not like very comfortable. I said, you know, my parents are also from village. No, don't be afraid, right? And so I think that shared context, I believe, you know, actually gives a lot of courage, you know, to people, right? So when people know that our context and, you know, our objectives and our culture, our values, you know, these things, you know, there is like a lot of shared similarities that actually gives a lot of comfort. Because of comfort, you get trust. Because of that, you get courage, right? So when you have that CTC together, you know, I think good things will happen.
Awesome. And so we covered the founders. Now let's cover the idea, right? So how did the concept of Atomic come about?
So I think at Nutanix, I have seen, you know, the challenge of managing internal processes, internal workflows as companies grow. And Parsu and Kiran also have seen this at Freshworks, right? And in Nutanix, we used to have this leadership offsites to, you know, bunch of them, we got Frank Slootman, who is currently CEO of Snowflake. So he was like, I think, transitioning out of ServiceNow then, before he took up Snowflake. So he used to spend time with, you know, Nutanix folks. I think Frank once basically told that, you know, the if you want to really build a great company, right, great company, you have to either own the front office workflows, or you have to own the back office workflows, or you have to own the infrastructure workflows, okay? And the infra for you is like, you know, you're an operating system, you're a database, you're a network, right? You can build an incredibly big company in that space. Or you own the back office, you know, which is like, you know, you own this whole, you know, service management, you go own, like, you know, you're like a ServiceNow or a Workday or a SAP, like, you know, Oracle Financials, you know, like these are all like a very, very big companies even today. And or you go to front office, you know, you go build the CRM, you know, like, you know, your marketing automation, you know, etc. He said the easiest company to build is a front office company, right? But that's also fast changing kind of a landscape, right? The next hardest thing is to go build, the middle office thing and, you know, back office thing, you know, then really like the underlying infra thing, right? He said the fact that you guys are going and building an infra software company itself can turn this into one of the biggest companies, right? Assuming, you know, you do like a lot of things well and right. So that's what Dheeraj used to tell me, like, we can build a $100 billion company, right? Nutanix, we can turn Nutanix into a $100 billion company. And he had conviction for it. Obviously, like every story, you know, first time founder building, you know, IPO-able company, then a $10 billion market cap company, you know, getting to a $1 billion ARR, you know, itself is like a remarkable feat, right? But then he also, you know, you also need to build company with a context, the present context. One thing that Nutanix got so well, which was the technology, which was like as good as a cloud technology. I think one thing probably we didn't get it right, which is instead of taking this SaaS kind of a sales motion, we took the legacy infrastructure kind of a sales motion, which is go through partners, resellers, and, you know, high field, you know, high sales, you know, enterprise-y approach. And the cost of sales and marketing is so much, you know, to get that right, especially when you're transitioning from an on-prem software to cloud software, going from like 7-year contract to, you know, subscription contracts and all, brings like a lot of challenges, right? So we basically, personally as a co-founders among us, we felt this problem firsthand. And I always believed that there is an opportunity to go build. So when you, let's say you start a company, you hire 10 engineers. What's the first software you buy? You go buy some project management software for this. When you hire 10 salespeople, you go buy, Salesforce or some, customer management, lead management software, right? When you have 5, 10 marketeers, you go buy support people. You know? But when you are 500 people, what do you go buy? There is no answer. The answer is you basically, buy email software, which is from your day one. You buy some chat software. Then you expect that somehow magically, as your company is scaling, you can manage all the workflows, in disparate tools, right? And this is one of the fundamental reasons I actually believe what stops most companies, to become a growth is their back office doesn't scale, right? Then they basically are in this, journey or a circle of let's bring some leadership, let's find some product, put it, change processes, suddenly we can fix, we can actually meet our growth aspirations, right? So we said, look, there is an opportunity for us to go build a internal operating system. And this internal operating system has to work with your employee directory, your IT directory, your work, and it has to become like your workflow directory for the company, right? So whether it is your traditional things like your HR IT or your, procurement things, your sales ops things, or, even some of your vendor workflows, partner workflows, or even customer workflows, you should be able to do from this internal operating system. So that's a journey that we are on right now.
So I used to see some of this at my previous gig where, we were in one office in India, yeah. Then we started hiring internationally, yeah. Right? When you are in the same office, you know who to talk, yeah, to for what, yeah, right? Now someone sitting in the US in a different time zone doesn't know if my payroll has a mistake, who do I go to?
Yeah.
I was the responsive one, so I would get all the messages, yeah, at like 12 and 1 and 2 in the morning, hey, my payroll is late, I'm having this problem, I want access to that tool, who can help me out?
Yeah.
Right, and that's where I think some of these systems come into play, right? So I think interesting category for sure, right? Yeah. Now when you identified the problem, how did you go about maybe validating or thinking, yeah, about the solutioning, yeah, around it, right? And I'm assuming over here there might be lessons for first time founders as well, because you're doing this, yeah, it's your second innings, right? Yeah.
So we went and naturally, you see, as a founder, you have some conviction of, how you want to come up with a solution for it. But, you need to go and talk to people to really understand the depth of the problem and the breadth of the problem, right? See, as a founders, we understand, I have seen, some breadth of the problem, some depth of the problem, of different tools, right? So what did we do at Nutanix? I think just before IPO, we went and put ServiceNow, then we went to Workday, and then we basically said, okay, we created a SaaS engineering team, and we said, okay, we'll do integrations with like a lot of different tools. Then we'll build, code to cash, code to order, kind of a tool, and we'll build some self-service. We'll deploy some virtual bot software so that employees can get faster responses. So I kind of have seen, the solutioning approach, but we basically said, you have to converge. Bunch of workflows to provide right experience from an employee standpoint and a right efficiency from an enterprise standpoint and a right, integration from an IT kind of a standpoint, right? So we went and spoke to a lot of people and now, day one as a startup, you can't go compete against ServiceNow, right? And which essentially means, you have to go to a segment which has the problem, the painful problem, but maybe the scale of the problem is, slightly smaller. So we went and spoke to 500 people kind of a companies to 50,000 people companies also. And then we basically said, okay, as a startup, I think we need to start this journey at like this 500 to 1,000 people kind of a company to solve their problems. Then we said, okay, we, even though our ambition, long-term ambition is to go solve it for everybody, we can't start from day one like that. So we have to pick one or two personas. So I think the first 3 to 6 months, we went and, even before we started, we went and spoke to a whole bunch of people, right? And then, started spending more and more time trying to understand how are they doing, what tools they are using, why they upgraded from one tool to other tool, why they have a current tool, but still they have a problem, etc. And then we said, okay, I think we can look at IT workflows and we can look at HR workflows. That's how we spent, I think, first 9 months or so. Or last 3 months, we said, okay, I think let's go attack IT workflows first, you know, then we'll come to HR workflows and stuff. Because we also now started doing top of the funnel, right? So when you go, you know, pitch that problem to a person, how much urgency are they showing to engage with you to see the product demo, right? Are they saying, you know, hey, let's set up next, you know, tomorrow or day after tomorrow? Or they're saying, you know, I'll come back to you with a slot, right? So we felt this IT persona is showing like a lot of conviction. So go, you know, deep into that. So the lessons there is, you know, as a founder, your customer don't know what they don't know, right? But if you show them, right, or if you describe them, if you visualize, you know, about it, they might be able to help you refine it. I think you can use customers to understand problems really well.
So maybe go a little bit deeper on process. One, just describe how many people did you speak to?
So I think before we started company itself, we spoke to 20, 30 people.
And you know,
and
in
after that, we spoke to at least 100 plus people.
So I remember that, and you know, you didn't write code forever, which frustrated us.
Yeah, yeah.
And you said patience. So, but you know, but you, I think you made a lot of wireframes,
yeah,
different
yeah,
flows, and
yeah,
testing that out.
Yeah.
And just describe some of that in detail, because I think for a first-time founder, they start building immediately.
Yeah, yeah. I think code is the easiest thing to do, right? Because all of us are engineers. And we have this eagerness to just go write code kind of thing, right? I think what you really, really, especially in a B2B software, when you are targeting, you know, this mid-market to enterprise kind of a thing, understanding your customer context matters a lot. So I'll you know, peel what I meant by customer context. What tools they use, right? Because that determines what integrations your software actually needs. And what their jobs to be done looks like for your persona, right? And what are the switching costs for them? Okay, if you assume tomorrow you have this entire solution, you take it to them, but what does the switching cost look for them, right? Do they get 10x better value? Do they get like, you know, 5x cheaper, you know, solution? So if you don't talk to them, you know, then you will assume, you know, you will assume it, okay, I know, let me just go do Okta integration because that's what you heard as a SSO. When you go talk to mid-market customers, more often, I mean like 80% of them are still running with AD, right? Then you realize, okay, the integration I need to do is AD, not the Okta, right? I think as a founder, you know that you are on this journey. This whole MVP, I think we have overdone it. You know, this minimum viable product thing, I think we have overdone it. I think you really need to create this minimum value kind of a product for, you know, your initial segment. For you to create value, you really have to understand, you know, your customer context, their operating context, their workflows context, their pain point context, and their switching, you know, costs kind of a context, right? If you don't understand it, you take that product, they might like something, they might not like something, your initial go-to-market takes, you know, like you'll have a lot of friction in it, or you might not be able to even scale well with it, right? So my thing is, don't be in a hurry to write code, okay? Be in a lot of hurry to understand your customer pain points, problems, rather than, you know, going and refixing your code, you know, etc. I think spend the 30 days or 60 days to understand. Doing upfront work actually helps, okay? But once you decide on, you know, that, so I'll give you an example, right? So initially we thought we'll take 18 months to 24 months to launch this solution. Then we said, okay, that's long. We have to launch this in 6 months. So that's when, like, you know, March is when we started giving it to early set of folks. And then, you know, from last couple of months, you know, we started giving it to more folks. Now we are saying, okay, in a year we have to go to market, right? Because what customers are really good at is helping you take from 1 to 100 in your product journey. What else is needed? You know, how this can be done, etc. Right? Otherwise, like, as you know, people joke, right? Like, you know, if the world was all using horses, if you ask someone, what do you want? They would say, I want a faster horse instead of a car. But once you tell them the car, they will tell you, I need a better window, I need a seat, you know, I need this, you know, I need extra mileage, you know, I need brakes. They will take you from the 1 to 100, right? The real great value contribution founders do is the 0 to 1 of the product. Your customer will do 1 to 100.
No, I remember 5 months after investing, I asked you, what are you building? You said, give me one more month.
So I think it was, you know, frustrating even personally for me also. Look, I think I showed this to you folks, right? I genuinely believe the act one of a company is in a what we call iteration mode, right? So you're experimenting with a bunch of approaches to solve the problem, right? So why we spent that first 4 or 5 months is we were trying to find what approach should we take to solve the problem, rather than thinking, this is the only approach, we'll just give it and we say, this is the approach, right? So we tried a few things and then we said, maybe this is not the right approach. So we should actually change the approach. It saves time and effort. And also, when you go to a customer, right, you also have rights to win. A lot of us take products to customer without having any right to win, right? What I mean by right to win? A right to win is, we go to a customer and the customer cannot plug his IT directory to your product. You first, you don't have, there is a friction point. You can say, whatever, right? Then second, the customer has some data somewhere, he can't just bring the data into your system, then you don't have a right to win. Third one, you have not done a basic compliance, you don't have, these days, like when we built initially SaaS, people were like, compliance is good to have. These days, compliance is must to have. And so like that, you also have to add rights to win to your product. So customer, when he sees it, he thinks, okay, this is a thoughtful team, thoughtful product. They are on a right journey, right? Not like, create some, random thing, give it to them and say, my UX is bad, but don't feel I'm an MVP, right? The experience, the value, and the integrations is your problem. It's not your customer problem.
No, I think another thing that I'll also call out where this becomes interesting is, I think in that journey, you want the right foundation, and a lot of these decisions are almost irreversible, right? Or they're hard to change in hindsight, but maybe the persona has evolved through the discovery process, the initial approach of product, the insertion point of what stage of company, what's the first job to be done that I can cover. And getting those right is very important. Otherwise, you'll build for 1 year, and then when you ship, you'll learn the hard way that this doesn't work.
I think we create path dependency. So I call, so as a founders, we create path dependency for our company by hiring people. If you don't hire really, really great people, you create a path dependency for your company, right? Because those people will hire. If you don't have a good culture, you create a path dependency for company. If you don't have right technology, you create a path dependency for your company. So what you said is so true. I think founders have to think a lot about their path dependency, because the early decisions affect the path dependency for your company, right?
So since you mentioned this and you mentioned hiring great people, right? I'll probably latch on to that and let's talk about this. So I was speaking to Sai and he said, you probably have 5 CTOs on the team, not just one. So what was the approach on building like such a senior team so early, and how do you also convince all of them to work together?
Right. Yeah. So I think some of it is like, good luck, I have to say. And some of that is also, I have to give it to those people, right? And their belief in it. I think there is a good side of having, people with a lot of depth and breadth, but there is also not so good side of it, right? But I think the reason why we basically wanted to bring people who really, really understood things at depth or have, really, really good breadth is also the problem that we are going after is not a simple problem, okay? If it is a simple problem, you can take an approach. So, every founder thinks the problem they're solving is the most complex problem, right? But as I said, look, we are solving we are trying to build internal operations operating system, okay? So think of it like an X service now, right? And that company, creating a company like that is very different approach versus creating a company where you say, I'll build one product, then I'll build product 2, product 3, product 4, product 5. Through these 5 products, I'll get to 100 million ARR or whatever, 500 million ARR kind of a thing. That's a very different approach, right? So we knew from day one, it has to be one product solving, 5 use cases instead of like 5 products solving, 5 use cases, right? So we basically said, okay, we need, really, really good set of people. And we were super fortunate, right? So I actually told Akash, who was my previous CTO, I said, there is no job for you in this, this new startup. And to his credit, he said, and the reason I told him is, look, even the founder CEOs leave the company faster than the founder CTOs, because the CTOs stick around in a company for a very long time. And, you know, since my co-founder is a CTO, there is no job for you here. He said, I don't care about being a CTO at all. I will write code. You know, I really like working with you. I respect Kiran because he and Kiran had, you know, some interactions when we were trying to sell something to Freshworks. And he really liked them. He said, you know, I will come and work, right? That's how we, you know, landed up with, you know, like this good set of people. So the credit, I think I have to give it to them more than me taking credit. But the thing I told them is, look, this problem is really worth solving. And if we get this right, this is a very big opportunity. And we can also create a different playbook, right? So the playbooks, if you have seen from India so far, you go create like 100 applications, like Zoho kind of a playbook, right? And then the Freshworks playbook is, you know, you go create 10 products, right? But actually with one product, you can actually create like a very different thing. So I said, okay, we are making a different attempt. It's a complex attempt. It's possible that, you know, we might fail in this attempt, but at least we have to make an attempt. And this, if it works, will help us build a much better company, both from a, you know, free cash flow perspective and long-term value perspective. And people believed, you know, in it.
But like you said, it's both things. I think one, you painted this vision that this is such a huge company that it can have, you know, tech leaders for 5 different things. It's not just one tech leader which will be respected. But I also think it is the maturity of these individuals, like you said, where they realize that, you know, the CXO title is an artificial barrier, right? Because they can, and they have now seen so many different organizations. Where you can have an architect who's super important, you can have another architect who's super important, and you can have an engineering manager at that same level, right?
I think, so I think titles, it's both. That's one of the reasons why we have not given titles, except the founders. We have not given titles. And we told people upfront, no titles. Because see, titles are meaningless. See, I mean, what's the point of somebody being a VP engineering with 3 engineers, right? First, we have to build a company. First, we have to build a product. The product will help us build a company. And when we build a company, you know, we can do everything. You know, we can create a VP, SVP, CVP, you know, all that. And I have seen, you know, I have seen people being a CPO of a public listed company, then going to Google and joining as a VP, right? So titles really don't matter. And people who are obsessed about titles, you anyway cannot hold them for a very long time. You better off, like, you know, avoid those people, you know, from coming on board.
Since you spoke about Akash and you said, I don't have a role for you, I want to talk about your anti-interview.
Sure.
Right? And I think for everyone here, it's basically, I think aligning incentives for early stage is very important, right? And like you said, if there's people who are money obsessed, title obsessed, they might not be good fits for the pre-PMF journey. But talk about your anti-interview.
So
process.
I think one of the things I do in Atomic Work is after we make the offer, I call that person. Tell them to think about all the reasons not to join the company, okay? And this I have tried doing to some extent in Minjar, but not to a great extent. But now I have, you know, I generally almost try to convince them not to join the company, okay? Because I tell them just because we are successful in the past doesn't mean we will be successful now, which is maybe not a great thing to say to my lead investors. And two, I basically tell them that we will not be able to give you hikes and raises that that might need it to meet your current personal needs. And three, there is no fast promotions here. And building companies takes 10 years. You know, I mean, building a company takes 10 years. Building a business will take another 10 years, right? So I always like discourage people from coming on board. And some cases it worked out. In some cases, people drop off, right? If they drop off, it's good. Right, so where it drops off is people will think, man, this founder has really good conviction, right? And he's very truthful. And a lot of people said, you are the first guy who told me after I got the offer why all the reasons why I should not join the company. Why? Because see, think about what do we do as founders? We are only selling the good things about the company, the opportunity, and all. We never tell the reality of what it takes to go get those things, right? So I use basically this as a reality check or anti-interview where I tell them all the reasons why this thing may not work. And if they cross that mental threshold and accept the offer, two things. One, tomorrow they can't come to me and, you know, complain saying, ek nahi chal raha hai, woh nahi chal raha hai, because they know that, okay, you know, there is the reality is most of the things don't work, right? Most of the things don't work. You have to bang, you know, your head against the wall, as that viral video yesterday or day before, the Sam Altman one, you know, went viral, right? This is what I tell people. You should expect that by default, nothing will work in startup. If everything is working, you should, you know, credit the luck, not yourself, if things are working, right? And some people dropped off. So I discouraged one person from joining because he bought a, you know, house with a large EMI commitment. And most of the first 20 people or so who came on board, all of them took a significant cut. I really didn't wanted this person to take a significant cut and then every month, you know, worry, not every month, maybe every week worry about money, right? You're better off hiring a fresher if you cannot afford experienced person who doesn't have EMI commitments. It works out well for you. And some of my team members don't like this because they think I am the reason for, you know, dropping the people. And but I genuinely believe those people. I mean, recently we made an offer to one product designer, you know, a few months back. And when I spoke to her, she said, you know, I want mentorship, you know, I want this, etc. I said, none of that will happen. If anyone gave you that, they're just telling. Because in startups, they don't have time to mentor you. You have to mentor yourself, okay? And two, you know, we cannot, you know, the second thing also we cannot do. Sure, she dropped off. So I think Persu felt terrible that, you know, what is this guy is doing, man, after convincing, you know, a product designer to come and join. And after we make an offer, this guy goes and says, hey, you should not join us because, you know, blah, 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 right? And why? Because startups need people who don't want autonomy, but they themselves are also autonomous, right? They have a desire to be self-directed. If the person who is coming into a startup doesn't have a desire to be self-directed, then you have to create a management layer in the company. Which startup, as a startup, I can't afford to create a management layer in the company in my early days, right? So at least if I have some products, some traction, some revenue, I can think, you know, I will do, like, you know, these things. Second, they have to have a desire to get better at their craft. If someone tells me that, you know, I have been whatever, X for some time, and now I don't want to do X job, I just want to manage people doing X, I will say this is not for you, right? I mean, recently also somebody, really good person and incredible profile, and said, you know, oh, I have done this for 10 years, you know, like I want to do something else. I said, unless you're willing to do the same thing for another 10 years, atomic work is not the place for you, right? And it was very disappointment for my team. Even for me personally, sometimes I feel maybe I should be opportunistic, maybe this one role, but I say, no, I think let people get into reality mode, let them cross that mental threshold, then they're better off, right, coming into company, because when they have that conversation with me, they know that, okay, this person actually told me, you know, the reality of what it is. I tell them, you know, expect our product not to become a hit, you know, expect our go-to-market to have challenges. You know, expect your campaigns not to work. Expect, you know, because in startups, if things are working, you should thank the luck, not yourself. You know, you know, because by design, you expect nothing to work. So the people also should know all the things, you know, that may not work. So I try not tell them reality and not sell the company and just see their conviction to come to a startup. And then, you know, at least those people, because I think as a founders, you need to select the DNA and also you have to edit the DNA, right?
Yeah, awesome. So you've hired the senior people. Sure. Everyone has high ownership, founder mindset, sure. Right? How do you think about your own management style, your role to play in all of this with such an experienced team?
So I think, super lucky, you know, that have a really good team, right? So actually, like, TJ, Tejashvi of Sequoia recently, I mean, like few months back introduced me to someone. He said, you know, he put together the best form, you know, team, best SaaS team kind of. But I think the reality is this, right? Experience is also curse, okay? The fact that you have so much experience potentially slows down. Startups need velocity, they need momentum. You shouldn't be afraid to make like a lot of silly mistakes because, you know, like nobody cares about, you know, startup making a mistake about, you know, something. But the problem with like people with their own brand, you know, their own profile in the ecosystem, you know, with their own like standing, is you don't want to look stupid, right? So let's say I don't want to look stupid. Or like the same thing with marketing person, same thing with product person, same thing with like, you know, whatever different roles. So this actually slows down. So one of the things I always tell people is what will kill us is, you know, not having intensity in a short run, in a long run consistency. I think startups need intensity in a short run, consistency in a long run. If you don't have intensity in the early days, there is no way you can create a momentum, right? So people basically feel, man, how can you act one day like this man with no patience and one day you act like a Zen guy? I basically say, look, you have to be impatient on the current mission, but execution, you know, you basically don't cause trouble, right? When people are executing, don't cause trouble. But when you're going into that mode, you know, you really, really have to have, you know, high intensity, but at the same time, you know, I also trust people, right? Like, you know, in the sense, generally I have done this, sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work. I always start with 100% trust, then start adjusting it, rather than start with 0% trust, you know, start accumulating it, because it makes it so easy for you to just give things and, you know, like let them also play. I think what people generally want is they want freedom. Right? Freedom to do things, freedom to make choices, etc. As a founder, my job is to give direction. And I also discourage a lot of heroics, right? Because I'll say heroics will only save us once or twice or thrice, right? And we have to get to thoughtful work, you know? So the internally, I basically tell them, my job, Kiran's job, Parsu's job is selecting the work, right? So we select the work with product managers, designers to shape the work. The engineering ships the work, this marketing and sales sells the work, and then we need to succeed with that work. So if I do a bad job as a founder selecting that, then I'm wasting so many people's effort, right? My product effort, my design effort, my engineering effort, my marketing effort, my sales effort. So I have to do a really good job of selecting the work. Once I select the work, you know, let them shape the work. And once they shape the work, you know, then let the engineering ship the work, right? Now, so people, you know, because a lot of them are experienced, they say, you know, man, you should become like a preacher instead of, you know, this. You have a framework for everything. But I generally say, look, our moral responsibility as a founders is super high. If we come up with if we select a bad work, then everybody wastes their effort. So I generally take like a super, I get like very paranoid in terms of work selection, both in selecting the work, shaping the work, shipping the work, you know, I give. And I also believe founders have to understand the reality, right? Vijay Shankar, who is my one person go-to-market sales support person right now, if he's not able to, let's say he's doing outbound, if he's not able to elicit interest, then I have to try before I say you are not doing a good job, right? I have to assist him, you know, help him, not say, okay, let's hire someone. So I discourage people from actually hiring people unless we do the job, right? Because if we don't do the job, what we did 10 years ago is useless because everything has changed, right? 2013 SaaS is very different from 2023 SaaS. 2015 go-to-market is very different from 2023 go-to-market. 2020, you know, design is very different, product design is very different from 2023 product design. So my thing is, I am a very intense person. I bring that intensity. And I also give people the freedom and the calmness. So during execution, you know, they are not disturbed, you know, again and again. And try to eliminate, right? And my job is to basically make sure that, you know, select the good work, you know, edit, you know, all this roadblock so that people can actually, you know, do the good work. I think we have a lot of job, a lot of jobs to be done to create, you know, a harmonious kind of a system, you know, which can, you know, continue to, you know, improve it, right?
Before we end, do you have anything more?
No. So, like I said, he's the professor with a lot of framework. So this can go on for 10
This is what
hours.
Reading does. So,
yeah.
So or spending time with Dheeraj kind of people.
So since he said reading, right, I also heard that, we as mere mortals have 24 hours in a day, Vijay has 28 hours or 30 hours. And I don't know how he consumes so much, but internally they also have a Slack channel called Vijay Reads.
And my CTO has set up. Yeah.
Because he wants to spread the pain. It's because otherwise only he will get all the reads.
Yeah.
So everyone gets to read what Vijay reads.
I think you are basically getting too much of inside though.
So one last question before we let you go, which is sort of, what is AI native SaaS? And I know it can go for a long time, you know, what's, and you know, we hear a lot of ChatGPT4X type pitches, which is, that is AI native SaaS. What's wrong with that approach?
So, I think, I don't know if I have a great answer for it, but I generally like always look at things from a little bit of, you know, historic perspective, right? So I think we know that it's an order 10 magnitude earthquake, right? AI is an order 10 magnitude earthquake. We know that all landscapes will be remade, or at least most of the landscapes will be remade. What we are trying to figure out, you know, as entrepreneurs and investors, is what are those first set of landscapes which will be remade faster than the other landscapes, right? You know, because of this. And so the thing is, somebody can, so for me, everybody, like already we have seen this, all the incumbents have added a AI layer, right? Whether it's a Microsoft, Salesforce, you know, it doesn't matter. Everybody has added a layer, AI layer. So a startup also adding the AI layer is no competitive advantage, right? So the way for you to go build a competitive advantage is you have to rewire the workflow, right? So for me, if somebody says, I'm AI native, let's take example of marketing automation. Have this person completely rewired the workflow, or he's talking about, you know, generating email, generating some content, generating some image and saying, you know, hey, I am, you know, AI marketing automation solution, right? The reason why I basically say is that incumbents always will add things only, you know, this startups are the ones who can think about, you know, actually rewiring it.
Actually, right? Incumbents can't subtract features. Yeah. And maybe so, becomes very powerful.
Yeah, that's a great point. Actually, incumbents cannot subtract. You know, only startup, when in the process of rewiring, they can subtract a lot of things or at least make those things invisible so that the workflow looks like radically different workflow, right? Now, the problem is 99% of the world will not buy this new workflow solution or a rewired workflow solution. That's an opportunity for startup, right? Start with that 1% and eventually go. The great example for this is there is two schools of thought right now. In AI race, mostly incumbents will win, okay? Which is like one conviction from folks, you know, at least who have seen 30, 50 years of investments and some pattern matching. But my belief is this. My belief is, there used to be a great automobile company before Ford in US called Stanley Motors, built cars using steam engines. When internal combustion engines came, they said, oh, no problem, you know, we'll just swap the engine for this, sell the car, we have great brand, you know, who are these Ford fellows to win against us, right? But Ford guys went and rewired the entire workflow for internal combustion engine, not just like swap the engine, right? So if you treat AI like just, you know, some technology, I will put it on top of, you know, whatever I'm building or what I want to do, it's very hard for you to win because everybody will do it. You have to deeply think about rewiring it, and it's a very hard thing. And rewiring the workflow for me is the native AI capability.
I think that's a great note to end on. And I know, you know, you think about rewiring the workflow, but you're also rewiring your entire company to think AI native in order to design those workflows.
Have to, right? Because if people don't use it, a lot of different tools in engineering, sales, marketing, as a founder, product manager, design, there is no way you can understand how much value this thing can create. If you don't realize, you never believe in it. If you don't believe in it, you don't act on it, right? So what you said is great. You know, before you rewire the product, rewire the company to AI.
Good. Vijay, every time we have these conversations, I'm reminded of how thoughtfully you're sort of building the company, how thoughtful you are about, you know, where to play and also how to play. So thank you again for the privilege of investing, and really looking forward to the journey ahead. I will encourage all our listeners to actually listen to this podcast twice, because there's just so many nuggets that I took away that it probably is a podcast that is worth listening to a couple of times
and
to get everything you want to
find. Vijay, there's one Irani chai shop in HSR.
Yeah, my office is right in front of that. And thank you for having, great questions, and I really look forward to this journey with you folks.
Awesome.
Thank you.